From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with writer Philippe Wamba about the affinity between African Americans and Africans, as well as the differences that divide them. Wamba is the son of an African American mother and an African father who now leads a Congolese rebel group. Wamba has lived in both Africa and the United States. His new book is called Kinship. Also, trying to keep up as new technology accelerates the pace of just about everything. We talk with James Glick, author of Faster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The eye of Hurricane Floyd is moving over the northwest Bahamas, and the storm is nearing the Florida coast with winds of 140 miles per hour. Ed Thompson reports.
The high winds of Hurricane Floyd are only part of the destructive force of this storm. As Floyd moves up through the northwest Bahamas, up to 10 inches of rainfall is combining with storm surge flooding that forecasters say could reach 20 feet above normal tides. It is difficult to determine just how extensive the damage is because the storm has knocked out communications in the hardest hit islands of Eleuthera, Cat Island, and New Providence. Floyd has turned to the northwest, and that could bring it even closer to the central and northern Florida coast in the next 24 hours. Rain bands from Floyd are spreading over the Florida coast. Landfall is most probable Tuesday or Wednesday from the North Florida coast up to the Carolinas. A hurricane warning has been extended northward along the Georgia and Carolina shore. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson reporting.
South Carolina Governor Jim Hodges has ordered the evacuation of his state's coastal areas as Hurricane Floyd approaches. Hodges said the order affects about 800,000 people. The Red Cross is standing by to receive people at nearly 100 shelters further inland. The mayor of Charleston is urging all residents to leave the city, and about 7,000 recruits are being evacuated from the Marine boot camp at Parris Island. In Northern Ireland, one of the most notorious terrorists has been freed from the Mays prison. Johnny Mad Dog Adair was released under the terms of the peace agreement. Marianne Maguire reports from Belfast.
The former commander of the Ulster Freedom Fighters was freed after having served 4 years of a 16-year sentence for directing terrorism. Johnny Adair gave a clenched fist salute as he emerged from the jail. He is the 293rd prisoner to be released under the terms of the peace accord, which guarantees that paramilitary prisoners can be freed early. It is not known how many murders Adair was responsible for, but at one time he boasted that he had murdered as many as 30 Catholics in 15 years. His release has occurred as peace talks aimed at resolving the crisis in the peace process have resumed. Former U.S. Senator George Mitchell met today with the leaders of the main political parties. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Maguire in Belfast.
Rescuers are still probing the wreckage of a Moscow apartment building that was blown apart yesterday by a suspected bomb. So far, at least 120 people are confirmed dead in the blast, which is the fourth major explosion in Russia in the past 2 weeks. Russia's interior minister said today that police found nearly 2 tons of explosives and a fuse in another apartment building in southwestern Moscow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 120 points to close at 10,910. Declines led advances in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The broadest gauge of the nation's trade performance, the current account, showed a record deficit in the second quarter, according to data released by the Commerce Department today. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Fueled by a flood of imported goods and higher prices for imported oil, the U.S. current account deficit widened to more than $80 billion in the April through June period. That's up almost 18% from the previous quarter. The current account is the most complete measure of the nation's trade situation because it tracks investment flows and foreign aid payments, as well as trade in goods and services. During the second quarter, the U.S. trade gap in goods widened 14%, while the U.S. surplus in services narrowed. The U.S. deficit in investment income widened slightly. The current account is on track to produce a $30 billion deficit this year, partly because the Asian crisis hurt demand for U.S. goods, while providing cheaper imports for U.S. consumers. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Trade Commission said today that it's taking action against companies that offer phony credit card protection plans. The plans are sold by telemarketers who tell consumers that the plan will protect them from being held liable for charges they do not make. Such protections are already guaranteed by federal law, which says credit card holders can't be held liable for more than $50 in unauthorized charges. The FTC said telemarketers sometimes claim to represent major credit card companies and tell consumers that they could be held fully liable for charges to which they didn't agree. Attorneys general in Arizona, Florida, and other states are planning similar steps. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the son of an African father from the Congo and an African-American mother, Philip Wamba is well aware of the myths that Africans and African-Americans hold about each other. His new book, Kinship, explores those myths and the culture and politics that unite and divide the two groups. Wamba was born in 1971 and spent the first 8 years of his life in the U.S., mostly in suburban Boston, while his father completed his advanced studies and taught. The family moved to Tanzania when Philippe was 8. He returned to the U.S. to study at Harvard and Columbia. Throughout his life, his father, Ernest Wamba Dia Wamba, has been an opponent of the corrupt governments in his native country, Congo, formerly Zaire. But a year ago, he crossed the line from intellectual dissident to rebel leader of a group trying to overthrow President Kabila. 2 weeks ago, he signed a peace agreement. If it holds, it will end the fighting in Congo that started last year. Philippe's parents met in 1965 when they were both students at Western Michigan University. Their decision to get married was met with some concern on his mother's side. For example, her parents worried that their daughter's African fiancé could be a polygamist.
This is one of the very, very common ideas about Africans that persist among African Americans. And of course, it has its basis in reality where, you know, in that polygamy is indeed practiced among a number of African ethnic groups. So one of the early questions that parts of my mom's family had was, well, are you going to be the third or fourth wife? Are you going to be his only wife? And then there was another stereotype about African men being wife beaters, and would he be battering her? So there was these concerns about how she was going to be treated. There were concerns about would she be moving away from the United States, moving to Africa, where they didn't know very much about the continent or what to expect, and how would she cope over there? Do they have modern technology, modern amenities? So there's a lot of consternation on those, on all of those levels. But I think that ultimately, you know, having met my father and spent some time with him and been impressed with him as an individual, impressed with his intelligence, with his commitment. He was very academically inclined and very spoke often about how he wanted to return to his homeland and make some kind of a contribution in independent Congo. So I think that because of the personal example of that he brought, as far as when they met him, they were impressed enough to allay some of their fears about what my mother would encounter when she went to Africa.
You describe your mother as someone who had been a black nationalist and who was very, very interested in Africa even before you met your father. When you were growing up in the United States, growing up in a suburb of Boston, what impressions did you have of Africa from hearing your father talk about it and your mother, who had lived there briefly in the Congo before you were born?
My father would tell us these stories, my brothers and I, stories about his upbringing in the rural village in Western Congo where he grew up. And these were very nostalgic, fond, affectionate stories in which he talked about the stories that his mother would tell them around the communal fire in the evening, about tending the farms that his family, where they raised the crops that they subsisted on. So these, you can imagine, sounded completely removed and distant from my suburban experience in West Newton, Massachusetts. So using these ingredients, I, you know, sort of cobbled together my own conception of what Africa was all about, and had this very strong sense of identification, sense of pride, sense of wanting to visit and wanting very much to move there, and had the opportunity when I was 8 years old and my family moved to Tanzania.
And they moved to Tanzania. Your father had accepted a teaching position at a university in Dar es Salaam.
Yes.
Your father is a scholar of history. So you moved there when you were eight, and suddenly all the fantasies that you had were supplanted by the reality of being in Tanzania. How did the reality of your new neighborhood and your new kind of family life compare with the fantasies you had in your mind?
Well, the fantasies that I had were basically that, fantasies. They were the stories that were, you know, passed down to me. Just sparked my imagination and sent it in all sorts of new directions. And then arriving in Tanzania, there wasn't that much that was familiar, even from the stories that had been told. But still, I found this place that just tantalized me in all sorts of ways, in terms of my imagination, in terms of new experiences. I guess, you know, it's important to remember that I was 8 years old at the time, and that it was just an experience of experimentation and just learning the language, learning new foods, learning the new landscape, new games, learning, making new friends. So it was an amazing experience of discovery. And I guess I had been prepared to have such a positive experience of it by the positive expectation that had been created by my parents, who had passed on such affectionate, fond, and proud images of their experience of Africa. So it was a true homecoming.
No, you had spent the first 8 years of your life mostly in a suburb of Boston, a predominantly white suburb of Boston. What was it like in terms of like your identity to go from being, a black person in a predominantly white suburb of Boston to moving to, you know, Dar es Salaam, where, you know, it's a black African population? Did you have a different sense of what it meant to be black?
Well, yes. I mean, I can remember arriving in Dar es Salaam at the airport and being impressed, very strongly impressed by the fact that everywhere I looked were black people. Dar es Salaam also has a large Asian community, Asian as in from India, and has a large sort of Afro-Arab community. So all of these, you know, various shades of brown, basically, were what impressed me when I first set foot on Tanzanian soil. But what sort of I came to understand was that the complexity of ethnicity in Africa, which has a more multifaceted aspect to it than in the United States, where things are often in binary black and white or various shades in between, but much more stratified than in Tanzania, because I found that while I had been a minority in a suburb of Boston as a black person, I was still a minority in Dar es Salaam, in that I was a foreigner. I was black, yes, but I was not a Tanzanian. I was not a member of any of the tribes that my playmates belonged to. So all of these things, it gave me a sort of much more complex appreciation of what identity meant in different contexts.
Well, when you were a boy, the government of Zaire, which is now Congo, was pressuring your father to return to the country because they thought that he was trying to overthrow President Mobutu, and they wanted to be able to keep an eye on him. He didn't want to go, so he instead was living in Tanzania with the family where he was teaching. But his father was dying in 1980, and he wanted to see him, so he made a brief trip back to Zaire. And then the following year, in 1981, he went back, and the rest of the family, you, your brother, your mother, was supposed to meet him later at the airport. You showed up at the airport. You were still under 10 years old. And what happened?
Well, it was an especially traumatic experience in that it was supposed to be my family's first homecoming to the country of my father. This is my first time stepping on Congolese, then Zairean soil. And we were met at the airport by soldiers who informed us that my father had been detained for the possession of so-called subversive documents, which were critical of the regime then in power in Zaire. So it was quite a challenging encounter. My mother, then with three very young children, myself, I was 10 years old. My younger brothers were 7 and 3, respectively, I believe. And this was our first time visiting Kinshasa. We had, you know, my father's family has a number of family members in the city, but when we were met at the airport by these soldiers, we had no way of contacting them. We spent some days in the city trying to get in touch with my father's family, trying to get to see him in the prison where he was being held. It was a rather nightmarish experience, and I think had a big impact on myself and the rest of my family.
How did your mother explain to you that your father was considered a subversive by the government of the country he grew up in? I mean, how do you explain that to a 10-year-old?
Well, it wasn't as though I had never heard of Mobutu Sese Seko, who was then the president for life of Zaire.
Your father had already told you he was a bad guy.
Yes, basically. So I was aware that there was this regime in power and that my father was hostile to it for his own principled political reasons, and that it, I guess, vice, you know, that it was also averse to him, and that. But it was still something of a shock that he had been detained. He was an academic, a professor. It was difficult for me as a child to understand that just for writing an essay, which pointed out that he disagreed with certain government policies, that his life would be jeopardized for that act.
It took about a year of pressure, you know, not only from your family, but international pressure, before your father was released by Mobutu's regime. When your father was released, after being in prison and being tortured on and off for a year, was he a changed man? Did you sense any difference in him?
If anything, he was probably more committed to his goals and political beliefs. I think he had, as I said, been a patriot, had been deeply disturbed by the course that the country had taken under Mobutu. I think that after his experience in detention, he redoubled his efforts to try and work for change in Congo. Again, however, through the same channels that he had before, which was as an academic, as a concerned intellectual, writing essays which were critical, attending conferences. He would had contact with other dissidents who were critical of the government, and over the years he basically generated a quite impressive collection of work that relates to the political history of the Congo and the nature of oppression in Congo, and proposed some solutions, which is basically the work that led to his current activities. He's referring to quite an impressive collection of references.
When your father was in jail for the better part of a year, where were you and your family?
In Dar es Salaam. Well, mainly in Dar es Salaam, but partly my mother made a couple of trips to the United States trying to continue the campaign to gain his release. She made a couple of trips to Kinshasa to visit him while he was in detention and also continue the campaign. But my brothers and I were, for the most part, in Dar es Salaam.
My guest is Philippe Wamba, author of the new book Kinship. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Philippe Wamba, is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. His mother is African-American. His father is from Congo. Philippe grew up in the U.S. and Africa. Well, your father is now the head of a rebel faction that is trying to overthrow the government of Mobutu's successor, the government of Laurent Kabila. Your father's the head of the Rally for Democracy in the Congo, the RCD. He's been calling for a negotiated settlement, and a peace agreement was signed about a week ago. Hopefully it will hold. You say you found out about this from a news report. You didn't know that your father was leading this rebel group. What was it like to... Tell me about that experience.
It was a little bit of a shock, but...
This was about a year ago?
It was August of 1998 when the rebellion started. The rebellion started on August 2nd. And I read about it, I think, a couple of weeks after maybe, I think the movement was formally announced on August 12th or so. It was a bit of a shock, but it wasn't that surprising, if you understand what I mean. And what I mean by that is that over the years, my father has always been engaged, has remained very deeply involved in political movements for change in Congo. And he had already expressed great reservations to me about the regime that had taken over in Congo in 1997 when Mobutu was overthrown. There had been a great deal of optimism among Congolese and among Africans all over the world when Mobutu, this is like one of the last Cold War dictators who had ruled for 32 years, oppressive rule, kleptocratic rule, had, you know, pillaged the country of more than $5 billion. Was finally overthrown in April of 1997, and there was this great optimism that this would actually mean that there was finally going to be some substantive change for the Congolese people. When less than a year after Kabila took power, this hoped-for change did not really come to pass. Many, including my father, were very disappointed. And when the Kabila government sort of started taking steps that were even more alarming, initially it was, you know, the same sort of corruption, the same sort of a rule of one single ethnic group, the same sort of patronage and clientelism. And then when this sort of started leaning towards basically another genocide to follow the one that took place in Rwanda in 1994, for many, including my father, that was the most alarming step. And that was when this rebellion broke out in August 1998.
You have always known your father as a scholar, a university professor. Now he's a rebel leader. I mean, instead of just having the pen, he has the sword, so to speak. He probably had to learn how to shoot a gun.
Yes, he over the past year, he's learned a number of things, that being one of them. But the thing is, and something that was sort of has been argued back and forth when he first became involved, there's been this ongoing question. I'm sure it's been a question for many others, not just my father, historically. An academic or an intellectual who sees themselves as involved in a tradition of activism, presents itself this question of what is the limits of that commitment? Does one just theorize about politics and political change, or does one actually at some point take the step towards actually getting involved? There was an academic from Guyana named Walter Rodney who had taught at the University of Dar es Salaam shortly before my family moved there. And he had this famous phrase saying that it's not enough to merely study history. Ultimately, an academic has to get his feet wet. The point being that the ultimate and sort of logical conclusion to a tradition of scholarship and activism geared towards fundamental change was that ultimately you would be led into the struggle in a very active way, and that, I guess, is the path that my father has taken.
You're a historian yourself. I mean, history was your major. There's a lot of history in your new book. And I'm wondering if this is a bit of a call to arms for you as well, if it's making you rethink what your role should be as somebody who's steeped in history.
It has forced me to to question, to figure out exactly what my role will be. And I can't really say, I guess, in concrete terms at this particular moment, but I have this same sense of optimism that my father has, and I do feel like we are poised on the cusp of some significant change in Congo, and it's something I would definitely like to be a part of. I don't know if I would really call it patriotism that I feel for Congo, since I've only spent in total maybe a month in the country for political reasons, for reasons of circumstance, for reasons of where I grew up and where it was necessary for my family to live throughout the years of my childhood. I do feel at home in Tanzania. I have been to Congo on a number of occasions and have very close family ties there. I do see myself living in Africa at some point in the near future, and I do see myself weighing in whatever way I can on the side of African freedom, on the side of African democracy. I don't necessarily see myself taking an active role in politics, but I would like to make whatever contribution that I can, whether it's in terms of writing books like the one I just did, and which I hope will help to build some bridges as far as Pan-Africanism and as far as relations between Africans and African-Americans go, and as far as providing some of the historical knowledge that I feel is underemphasized. I was trying in my book to unearth some of the things that fascinated me that I thought were little known to Black people and to whoever else is these ideas resonate among. And hopefully I'm beginning, I've achieved that, but hopefully I'll be able to do more of that in the future. But
it sounds like you're still a little shy about being in the role of being a public speaker.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think the book is going to thrust you more in that position. And it's interesting that as you're being put in more of that position, you're watching your father be put in a very public position.
Well, I mean, I feel like I still have time. If he's in his mid-50s and now in that position, and I'm 28 and just wrote my first book and still, I think, finding myself professionally and otherwise. So all in good time.
Absolutely.
But I do feel like, as far as the book writing, I feel like I've learned a lot and learned the skills and tools that I can apply to another such project in the future or could go in any number of directions.
Philippe Wamba is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. We'll talk some more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide. On the web at Petopia.com. From Scholastic, publisher of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.K. Rowling, the third magical book set at Hogwarts, available wherever books are sold. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Philippe Wamba about Africans and African Americans. Also, how new technology has saved us time and robbed us of time. We talk with James Glick about his new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philippe Wamba. His new book, Kinship, is about the culture and politics that unite and divide Africans and African Americans. Wamba is the son of an African father and an African American mother. He spent the first 8 years of his life in the U.S., then lived in Tanzania until returning to the U.S. to attend college. When you went to college at Harvard, it was during a period when there was a lot of Afrocentrism in a lot of college campuses. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to be exposed to Afrocentrism in America after coming from Africa.
Well, the main thing that I sort of realized about Afrocentrism when I encountered it in America was that the Africa that was being celebrated by African-American Afrocentrists, it bore very little resemblance to the Africa that I had grown up in.
What were some of the differences between the Afrocentrism, the kind of Africanism Afrocentrism celebrated, and what you grew up with?
Well, one of the hallmarks of Afrocentrism is this emphasis on ancient Egypt and ancient Nubia. To my knowledge, or from growing up in Tanzania and East Africa, we didn't really have much sense of, I mean, those were things that were ground in ancient history and did not really have many sort of contemporary manifestations. However, among African Americans, some African American Afrocentrists would greet each other with greetings that were supposed to be ancient Egyptian, would dress in ways that were supposed to be inspired by ancient Egyptians. However, it seemed to me to be more of a celebration of that ancient past. But the outcome of that was that it not prevented, but allowed them to avoid confronting the contemporary reality of Africa, which to me was something that I found frustrating, because sometimes I would meet people who would express an interest in Africa, but after a few exchanges, did not seem to know very much about contemporary politics, about contemporary languages, culture, but did seem to have this very in-depth knowledge of some ancient traditions. So that was something that I found difficult to come to terms with at some points.
Now, you say in the book that although a lot of the students that you met had this kind of romantic notion about what Africa was and what it represented, that sometimes when faced with somebody who actually came from Africa, the African would be perceived as, quote, too white. And I'm wondering what accounts for that? What accounted for that?
I think there's a number of different things, but one of it is this sense of unfamiliarity, and that in America, things are often race relations and social groups are often reduced to this sort of binary divide between black and white. And from some African Americans that I had encountered, my sense was that if you didn't conform to a certain set of African American standards, some stereotypes perhaps, about what was expected of you as an African American, then you could be dismissed as too white. In America, race and the divide between black and white is sometimes all-consuming, especially for black students. In Africa, where that's less so, where some of the divisions might be more religious in nature, more tribal in nature, more ethnic in nature, geographical, class, if those are sort of the cleavages that people are more aware of or have more of a role in shaping people's viewpoint and in terms of situating themselves in the world, when they come to the United States without that sense of racial divide, it means that they relate to the world and to each other and to other black people in a different way. And that sometimes, I think, is part of the source of this alienation, discomfort, unfamiliarity.
Another set of differences that you found in terms of the way Africans see African Americans and how African Americans see Africans. In Africa, you found that a lot of people there felt like, why aren't African Americans more interested in Africa? Why aren't they doing more to support African causes? Why aren't they better read about African issues? And in America, you found a lot of African Americans felt, why don't Africans care more about what happened to African descendants after they were captured and taken into slavery and shipped off to the United States? Do you think that those are still kind of rifts between the two cultures?
Yeah, I think they are. And The big issue there in both of those cases, both of those perspectives are informed by a strong sense of expectation. And the expectation is based on this appreciation of kinship. On the African side, you have, Africans who have these myths of African-American richness or wealth and wonder why, if African-Americans are all wealthy, why they wouldn't come to Africa and help to uplift their African cousins.
And these images of wealth are because they see so many celebrities. They see, celebrity hip-hoppers and celebrity actors, and used to watch the Bill Cosby show, and that's what gives that sense of...
Yeah, and then on the other side, you have African-Americans who... there was a comedian, Eddie Griffin, who I think he has a television show, but on one of his stand-up routines, he had this, he was talking about why it was that Africans hadn't attempted to rescue African-Americans from slavery. And there is this popular perception that slavery was somehow a product of Africans selling off their undesired kin. And that's the source of some quite deep resentment that I've noted, regardless of how historically accurate that idea might be. Again, there's this expectation that if we are indeed kin, then why is it that we ended up in America? Why is it that you Africans don't seem to care about what has happened to us or aren't really involved with confronting some of the issues that we have to confront as Black people in America? And it carries over into the dynamic of the relationship between Africans who live in the United States and African Americans. African communities in this country, immigrant communities, have been growing for a number of years. But for the most part, these communities remain fairly insular and often have slightly antagonistic relationships with African American communities.
Do you hope to play a part in helping to translate African and African-American life to people living in the United States and in Africa?
It's something throughout my life, growing up first in the United States and then moving to Africa, especially when I was living in Africa, I would often, my brothers and I, would form this role as cultural mediators between African-Americans and Africans. Sometimes that was just a simple issue of translating from Swahili to English for an African-American traveler who was visiting Africa. And then even on this side of the ocean, Afro-Tanzanians who have come over here, sometimes people I've known, sometimes people I haven't, just acting as a sort of cultural guide in terms of getting them oriented. And so I have somehow felt myself sort of uniquely situated to be able to mediate across the divide and then hopefully to build bridges across that divide. And that's something I would definitely hope to be involved in the future.
Well, Philippe Wamba, I want to thank you very much. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Philippe Wamba is the author of Kinship, A Family's Journey in Africa and America. He's currently living in Cambridge and working for a website of African news. Coming up, how new technology is making us go faster and faster. This is Fresh Air. Our new technology is helping us get things done quicker. We're emailing and speed dialing, downloading things to read from the web, flipping through dozens of TV channels with our remote controls, and of course, multitasking every step of the way. And it's making many of us a little tense. My guest James Glick puts his finger on our culture's quickening pulse in his new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. He's the former New York Times science correspondent and author of previous books about chaos theory and physicist Richard Feynman. In his new book, Faster, Glick considers what we're gaining and losing as new technology speeds us up and offers a dizzying array of choices. For example, with the help of the Internet and CD-ROM, it's easier to get access to magazines, newspapers, and books than ever before. But there are consequences.
just saw that the entire corpus of Mad Magazine is being released on CD-ROM. You know, all the 700 or whatever it is issues from the 1950s onward, you can just call them up on your computer screen. Well, I remember when I was a kid, Mad Magazine was a sort of mysterious treasure. I would see it at friends' houses, and I never knew exactly how you got that. And when I had one, I just would sit with it for hours and hours and really study the thing. Not necessarily claiming that that made me a better person, but I gave it my all. If you can just press a button and get any one of 785 issues, it is just not possible that you're going to devote a full hour to any one issue. It's just not going to happen. And you have to ask whether something isn't being lost there.
Well, since time is what everybody's trying to save, you have some very interesting stuff about time in your new book. In fact, you visited the Directorate of Time. At least that's what it used to be called. What's it called now?
Now they're calling it the Time Service Bureau, I think. It's not quite as romantic a name. But
What is the Bureau?
Either way, it's the agency of the military that's responsible for telling us what time it is. They've got the atomic clocks. They've got a bunch of atomic clocks all scattered around a hillside and all linked fiber optically and all measuring time to the one nine billionth of a second and cooperating with counterparts overseas. This is not a purely American exercise either. And what time they say it is, that's what time it is. They determine the time. They don't just watch it go by. And everybody needs to know. Television stations and radio stations have atomic clocks. They have to be exactly accurate, or there are problems with their signal. And of course, the military uses precise timing to guide munitions these days because thanks to the global positioning system, time is equivalent to location, and one nanosecond, a billionth of a second, is equivalent to 1 foot, because that's how far light travels in that time.
Why is it part of the Defense Department?
Well, there is that military application, and I guess there's a historical reason, too, which is that time a century and a half ago was most important to all the people on Earth who cared about the time. The kind of person who cared most was a sailor, and for the same reason that time equaled position. You couldn't know where you were at sea if you didn't know exactly what time it was. So the naval observatories set standard time. This was in the era before railroads, and the Directorate of Time is in the old U.S. Naval Observatory building to this day in Washington.
Now, you visited, as part of the research for your book, an airline control center. And you write that the paradox of efficiency means that as the web tightens, it grows more vulnerable to small disturbances. Explain what you mean by that.
Yes. Airlines run more efficiently now than ever before. That's an undeniable fact. They use computers to schedule the flights and the movements of pilots and flight attendants and the timing of aircraft maintenance. And there are a thousand variables that they have to juggle, you know, union rules and fuel and winds. And it's a really complicated math problem, working out an efficient schedule that doesn't waste aircraft and doesn't waste crews staying overnight someplace when they don't need to. And if you track any particular plane from one place to the next, you discover that the computer has them going on weird routes. They don't just fly back and forth between New York and Chicago. They fly from New York to Chicago to Dallas to Phoenix to Toronto, and it's a long time before that route ever repeats, if it does. The problem is, because it's so efficient, there aren't extra planes sitting around with nothing to do or extra flight crews when something goes wrong. So if there's an equipment failure or a thunderstorm that delays a plane or a pilot oversleeps someplace, the effects of that can cascade through the system and be felt for days. They showed me, we looked in real time at the computer displays that showed them what flights were late and why. And there were flights that were late because of something that happened 2 or 3 days before. It's an interesting paradox, I think, that this tightening net of efficiency makes us, in a way, more vulnerable to disruptions. Inefficiency gave us a margin of error, and you don't have to look very far into your own life and your own schedule to see that that's true for you, too.
My guest is James Gluck, and he's former science correspondent for The New York Times, author of the book Chaos, and author of the new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. One of the devices now that saves us a few seconds and saves us some impatience is touch tone dialing, which, of course, isn't so new anymore. As you point out, it kind of premiered for the public at the 1964 World's Fair in the AT&T Pavilion. What was the promise of touch-tone dialing when it was such an exciting new development in telephones?
Well, touch-tone dialing was explicitly a time-saving device. That was the idea. I guess it's a sad fact that there are people alive today who might not remember that you used to have to move your finger around in a little circle to dial the telephone, and then you had to wait for the dial to click back. And I was a kid at the World's Fair in 1962 or 3, whichever it was, and I remember very well the display they had where first you were supposed to dial your own phone number and do it first on the old dial and then do it in touch tone, and a little electronic readout would tell you how many tenths of a second you had just saved. Well, that's kind of a crazy idea, isn't it? Saving tenths of a second. But the phone company, of all institutions, was and is intensely aware of how much we want to save time.
Of course, one of the paradoxes of touch-tone dialing is that although in many ways it saves us a lot of time, it's been adding a lot of frustrating time, like when you're trying to call, you know, a corporation or an insurance company or, you know, any company usually, and you get trapped in their automated voicemail system.
Yeah.
And, boy, it could take forever to get through that.
That is true, and there are a couple of things going on there. One is that a lot of those systems are just really badly designed, and the telephone is not a good instrument of information retrieval for a lot of things. In the long run, we're going to be getting our train schedules and making our airline reservations across the internet and not using the telephone for that. It's just not the right device. But the other thing that's happening, and this is something I try to explore in the book, is that the economy is changing because of our changing relationship with time. Companies know how important time is to the consumer, and they cater to our need for speed. I mean, there are whole segments of the economy that have popped into existence because suddenly we're in a hurry. We're fast food, overnight mail, FedEx. On the other hand, companies also have come up with some clever ways to shift time from you to them, from take it away from your budget and put it on their budget. It saves a company a lot of money to lay off the human beings who used to answer your question in detail and instead have an automated system where you punch a lot of buttons and wait on hold. And there's a time saving there, but it's not time saving for you.
Right. So you're losing time, but they're gaining it.
Right.
And it's apparently financially worth it to them, at least for now.
Yeah. And of course, it's like so many things, it's most true of institutions that have some sort of monopoly. So The telephone company tends to be worse than your internet service provider, and city and federal agencies tend to be the worst of all.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Glick. He's former science correspondent for the New York Times, author of the new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Glick, we're talking about his new book, Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. His earlier books include Chaos. You've been writing about speed during a period of your life that you've been forced to slow down. In 1997, you were flying your private plane and it crashed, and your son was killed in the crash, and you were, I think, drawn out of the plane, put on the critical list in the hospital. You survived, but you lost a leg, lost some of the use of your remaining leg. You were in the hospital for months, then went through a long period of physical therapy and rehabilitation. I mean, obviously, a lot of one's values change during a period of grief and trauma. I want to just focus on time and speed, since that's what your book is about. Did your whole sense of time and the meaning of time change, for instance, during those months in the hospital?
Well, that's sort of hard. I don't think the book changed in any real way. The book was mostly finished, and the things that I believed before the accident are the things that I still believe. But those months were certainly a strange period, and a period outside of reality almost. It's hard even to remember them. And I tried to work in the hospital after the first month or two, but certainly there was nothing like a regular daily routine. There was a daily routine, but it was like a daily routine of a prisoner. And there's no way to describe the grief that was the main feature of my existence. I mean, there's certainly no way to relate it to the book, but I guess you could say, if you wanted to explore this sort of issue, that there are times in our lives when the meaning of time changes for us and our perception of time changes, and it does make you realize that the perception of the passing of time depends on the flow of events in your life. It's not an absolute thing, time, for us. It's a very subjective thing. I do say in the book that a peculiar exception to all of these trends of acceleration and understanding of time is prison. Prison is a place in society where people do time, right? And they kill time. And the relationship of a prisoner with time is very different from the relationship of somebody who's rushing to work with a briefcase and grabbing a cup of coffee at Starbucks. The seconds and minutes and hours and days pass differently depending on your circumstance.
And when you're in the hospital, what you can't really rush. What you need is patience. And patience is just the opposite of what we've been talking about with multitasking and hurrying and all of that.
Yes. I'm not sure patience is even the right word. I wasn't there voluntarily.
Right.
You know, I was there because I had to be there. And I was healing at a certain rate. It is true that an important theme of my book is about the unchangeable rates of speed that are part of all of our lives. And a lot of those unchangeable things, kinds of timing, are biological things. I wasn't going to heal. There was nothing that was going to make me heal faster or grieve for a shorter time. In less profound ways, we have a lot of biological rhythms in our lives. I mean, you've got to sleep for a certain amount of time, and we all cheat on our sleep. You can't hurry love, as the song goes. Actually, the title of my chapter on this subject is "Decomposition Takes Time," because I came across, actually my wife came across a really funny thing on the internet by an expert in compost who was answering a question from a reader who wanted to know how to get the compost to go faster. And he was saying, well, you can't, you know, it's a biological process. Decomposition takes time.
Well, James Gluck, very good to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Terry.
James Gluck is the author of Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Elektra Entertainment, whose latest releases include Nancy Griffith's new album, The Dust Bowl Symphony, a collection of new recordings of her songs performed with the London Symphony Orchestra. By Dell Publishing, publishers of Under a Wing, a memoir by Reeve Lindberg, the youngest daughter of aviator Charles Lindberg, available in trade paperback. And from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The big winners at this week's Emmy Awards were The Practice and Ally McBeal. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from their creator, David E. Kelly. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.